This episode's sponsored by Good Ranchers. Most people don't realize this, but over 85% of the grass-fed beef sold in the U.S. is actually imported from overseas. It's a system that often pushes out American farmers and ranchers. That's why it matters to be intentional about where you buy your meat. That's why I choose Good Ranchers. Good Ranchers connects you directly with local American farms and ranches. 100% American meat, pasture-raised, no antibiotics, no added hormones. Delivered straight to your door. Make the switch to better meat. Go to goodranchers.com to start your plan and get premium American meat delivered right to your door. That's goodranchers.com. American meat delivered.
Here on Stolen Lives, we discuss brutal and heartbreaking crimes against children. Themes may include child murder, torture, and sexual, domestic, and child abuse. I do try my best to remain respectful for the babies in these stories and leave out unnecessary details that honestly, none of us need to know to understand the frustration of why and how this ever happened. However, if you find any of these themes triggering, this podcast may not be for you. Listener discretion is advised. This week's episode is a listener suggestion from Patreon. Thank you to Misha for bringing Danielle's story to my attention. Your note was the sweetest and actually made me tear up a little. I really do appreciate everyone who has purchased a book for my wish list. If you happen to forget to include a note, because there have been a few, please reach out to me in the DMs on social media. If you too want to suggest a case for me to cover in the next 3 months on the podcast, links how to will be in the show notes. February 2002, San Diego, California. Our father tucked his 7-year-old daughter into bed, a place where she should have been safe until morning. But horrifyingly, for Damon Van Dam, this ordinary act would turn out to be the last time he saw his daughter alive. A neighbour breaking into the family home in the early morning hours to steal away a family's innocence forever. This is Danielle's story.
I've never in my career seen a case where someone has actually gone into a home, taken a child out of bed, and taken that child back to his home, sexually abused and taken the child away, killed the child and dumped the body.
Danielle Nicole Van Dam was born September 22, 1994 in Texas, to parents Brenda and Damon Van Dam. Danielle was the youngest of three children with two big brothers. Danielle would later be described as being a very spunky young girl with a lot of personality. Danielle was basically a mini version of her mother, Brenda. Not only with their features, but they were both very much extroverts. They were social butterflies. It wouldn't be a weekend where the Van Dams wouldn't have friends or neighbours over for drinks or a get-together. Or one of them would go out while the other stayed home on kid duty. In February 2002, at the time our story takes place, the Van Dam family were living in the Sabre Springs neighbourhood of San Diego, California, having relocated there from Texas for Damon's work. He worked as a software engineer. Danielle was attending the local elementary school and was in the second grade. She was a smart little girl and super caring. She was the kind of kid that if someone fell over, she would be there to pick them up and to make sure they were okay. On the evening of Friday, February 1st, 2002, Danielle's mother Brenda had gone out with some friends for dinner and drinks, leaving her husband Damon home with the children. According to Damon, at around 10:30 p.m., he tucked 7-year-old Danielle into bed and went back down to the couch to watch some television where he fell asleep. Brenda returned home at around 2 a.m. with some friends. She noticed the side door to the garage ajar, with the security lights flashing, but thought nothing more of it. Brenda woke Damon, and the group chatted for about half an hour, before the friends went home and the parents went to bed without checking on the children, assuming they were sleeping safely in bed. I mean, why would you think otherwise? They were in the safest place they could be, tucked up in bed. Damon woke about an hour or so after this, and that's when he noticed the security alarm was flashing, but also the sliding glass door to the home was partially open. Thinking that maybe one of their friends had left it opened and forgot about it, Damon closed it and went back to bed. The next morning, everyone woke up and came down for breakfast. Everyone except 7-year-old Danielle. At around 9:30 a.m., Brenda and Damon searched the entire house but couldn't find her anywhere. She wasn't in her room, she wasn't in the backyard, she wasn't anywhere. They went immediately into panic mode and contacted the local police to report their daughter missing. Police arrived and they just start the search. It's very clear very quickly there is no sign of forced entry. But Damon and Brenda are adamant that Danielle wasn't the type of girl to run away. She wouldn't even leave the house without a trusted adult. And so the home was declared a crime scene, because obviously Danielle went somewhere. And so a missing person investigation was opened. Police officers canvassed the entire neighbourhood, and this was no small operation. There were 40 detectives assigned to the case. They were knocking on doors, searching in every bush, every backyard shed, searching for the sweet little girl who seemingly vanished into thin air. Police made an attempt to interview all the neighbours regarding Danielle's disappearance, noting that two weren't home, one of these being 49-year-old David Westerfield. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors.
This episode is sponsored by Good Ranchers. Most people don't realize this, but over 85% of the grass-fed beef sold in the U.S. is actually imported from overseas. It's a system that often pushes out American farmers and ranchers. That's why it matters to be intentional about where you buy your meat. That's why I choose Good Ranchers. Good Ranchers connects you directly with local American farms and ranches. 100% American meat, pasture-raised, no antibiotics, no added hormones. Delivered straight to your door. Make the switch to better meat. Go to goodranchers.com to start your plan and get premium American meat delivered right to your door. That's goodranchers.com. American meat delivered.
David Westerfield was a self-employed engineer. He graduated from James Madison High School. And in February 2002, when our story takes place, he was also a divorced father of two college-age children. He didn't really have any criminal record at the time. He had one drink driving offence from 1995, but nothing to show any kind of pretense for violence against children at this stage. Westerfield lived just two houses away and also owned what was described as a luxury motorhome. And as it were, he had been at the same bar as Brenda the night before, but had also suddenly vanished. He would actually buy Brenda and her friends drinks that night. But this was the kind of neighbourhood where you knew your neighbours, so this wouldn't have felt out of place for Brenda at the time, not considering her personality, where she was just friendly and chatted to everyone. Westerfield returned a couple of days later on Monday, February 4th, and he told police he really didn't remember how he got home from the pub on the Friday night, that he had been very intoxicated. But then he woke early on the Saturday morning, and despite being drunk just a few hours before, he decided on a whim that he wanted to load his RV up and go away for the weekend. He said he left around 9:50 a.m, so about 10 minutes after the Van Dams called the police to report their daughter missing. He said that the entire weekend he had just driven around San Diego, staying first at the Silver Strand State Beach Campground. He paid for 3 nights, and that's when he realised he had forgotten his wallet. Never to mind. He said he had enough supplies and was going to rough it out. But Westerfield then decided he was too cold and was going to drive back to his house for his wallet. Westerfield said he saw a large police presence in the neighbourhood. Now, instead of doing what I would assume most of us would do, and that's go find out what was going on. As I said, this was a close neighbourhood. Everyone knew everyone. Heck, Westerfield was buying drinks for his neighbours just the night before. I would assume you would want to know that everyone is okay. Or did something happen to your house? But no, in this moment, Westerfield realises that, silly him, he actually has his wallet after all, and just drives back. Not to the campground where he had paid the 3 nights for, but to some sand dunes about 160 miles away. Now, Westerfield being at the campground and the sand dunes for the weekend was verified by several groups of people, but also through cell phone records and gas receipts. So while his alibi was all incredibly involved and complicated, it was still believable that this was actually what happened. But what was strange and of concern to investigators, on that Monday morning, 2 days after Danielle was discovered missing, instead of coming home after a weekend of camping, which I have gone camping in the past, I cannot get home quick enough for a hot shower and clean clothes. But not Westerfield. He visited a dry cleaner's and dropped off duvets, pillowcases and a jacket. The dry cleaner would later report to police that he stood out to them at the time because when he walked in, he was dressed in a thin t-shirt, light shorts and was barefoot. He actually looked really dishevelled. What also stood out was that Westerfield paid a premium to have these items dry cleaned that same day. He then thoroughly cleaned his RV, but he failed to mention any of this to the investigators when he was interviewed. In fact, one of the officers involved in the search for Danielle, he noticed there was a garden hose stretched across Westerfield's front lawn, in an attempt, I would assume, to clean his motorhome. But this all looked very unusual and made him a person of interest in the disappearance. And then in questioning, Westerfield made an odd statement that he thought that Danielle was home with a babysitter that night, which we know is not the case. She was at home with her dad, and it wasn't like this was something the investigators had even brought up. He also strangely claimed that Danielle had visited his home a few weeks earlier to apparently sell Girl Scout cookies, and then she allegedly ran upstairs uninvited. Now, her mother would later say that this never happened, but this was obviously to cover to explain if investigators found any of Danielle's DNA in his home. Westerfield's property and motorhome were impounded. He was also placed under 24-hour surveillance. What was immediately apparent in the home was that one of the duvets was missing from Westerfield's bed. His house was immaculately cleaned, but also the garage smelled completely of bleach. A cadaver dog was brought in, and this dog seemed to hit on the garage door. The RV was searched from top to bottom, and authorities noticed that the duvet was also missing from this bed as well. And this definitely seems suspicious when combined with a dry cleaner visit. But the cadaver dog also showed interest in the RV, this time in a storage compartment and on a shovel. Now, this would have been devastating to the investigators, only confirming this was likely the worst case scenario here. In the end, they removed 13 bags of evidence. After a warrant was granted, Westerfield's computer was searched, and what they found was disturbing. The authorities found an excessive amount of child sex abuse material, or CSAM, as it's more commonly known as. And I don't refer to this as child pornography anymore, because that indicates a level of consent, and children cannot consent to this happening to them. It is child abuse, and it needs to be referred to in that way. Westerfield would initially claim that he must have accidentally accessed this material, but then has the gall of blaming this on his 18-year-old son. That it must have been him who had been looking up that material. This piece of shit literally threw his own teenage son under the bus to try and save himself. Now, obviously, his son denied looking this up or being involved at all. And given what Westerfield was now being accused of at this point, the investigators believed him. Investigators doubled down now, and they basically begged him to tell them where they could recover Danielle's body. And he just kept denying involvement in Danielle's disappearance. He even suggested that he may commit suicide if this line of questioning continued. He ended this particular interview by claiming he was being abused, quote, "No one is looking out for David's rights," unquote. Honestly, to me, he should have lost all his rights when he first started looking up the CSAM on the dark web, let alone when he murdered little Danielle. It was just after this time, the forensics came back on the items Westerfield left at the dry cleaners as well as the RV, and Danielle's blood was found on the jacket, the same blood that was identified on the carpet of the RV, specifically in the area between the bathroom and the storage compartment. And remember, this is where the cadaver dogs hit on in their search. Also, Danielle's handprint, along with several corresponding fingerprints, is found on a wall in the RV. And I don't know, just picturing that in my head really just punches me in the gut. It is heartbreaking picturing this tiny little girl, because she was small for her age. She never had a chance against this monster. But it wasn't just the blood. Investigators found several strands of hair that matched Danielle's DNA. and these were found in the bathroom of the RV and in the house, in the washing machine and dryer, and on the bedding in the master bedroom. Also, hairs were found that were determined to be dog hairs, and when compared to the Van Damme's dog, it was a near identical match. Now, obviously, they couldn't rule that to 100%, but visibly, they were determined to be from the same breed of dog as the family owned. Now, based on all of this, February 22, 2002, police returned to arrest David Westerfield for the kidnapping of 7-year-old Danielle Van Damme with special circumstances. And these special circumstances included kidnapping during a course of a lewd act upon a child under 14. And then, of course, there were additional charges because of the CSAM found on his computer. February 22, 2002, during his arraignment, Westerfield had the murder charge added to his growing list of charges. Because even though there wasn't a body at this stage, unfortunately, all the evidence the detectives had, this was the direction the investigation seemed to be headed. It was only now where did he dispose of the little girl's body. Now, of course, he declared his innocence and pled guilty to all the charges. He said he didn't know where Danielle was and hadn't done anything to her. Now, I imagine a big part of that is because if Westerfield was found guilty on the murder charge, well, California is a death penalty state. Although the alternative to that is life imprisonment without parole. So really, the future didn't look rosy for David Westerfield. But literally, while all of this was happening, heartbreakingly, tragic news was received by the investigators and the Van Damme family that Danielle had been found. For weeks, volunteers including the Laura Recovery Centre scoured remote areas in the search for Danielle. February 27, 2002, two volunteer searchers found her body near a trail in Dehassa, a remote area east of Danielle's home. Now, there had been prior searches of this area, but no leads had come about. Danielle's broken little body was basically dumped on the side of the road. She was nude and she was partially decomposed. Danielle showed signs of charring, which was consistent with exposure over several weeks to the elements, and her remains had been ravaged by animals. Because of the condition of the remains, the body had to be identified through dental records that it was indeed Danielle Van Damme. Now, because of the decomposition, the coroner wasn't able to determine a cause of death or whether the body had been sexually assaulted, even though the latter, come on, Danielle was found naked. And given the CSAM on Westerfield's computer, it doesn't take a genius to put two and two together and get a disgusting excuse of a man who obviously raped this little girl. Now, the area was immediately deemed a crime scene, and tire tracks would be found that, of course, matched that of Westerfield's vehicle. And so preparation goes into the pending criminal trial. And obviously this case receives an immense amount of public attention. I mean, how could it not? But this does become a major argument for the defence. Look, I don't hate defence lawyers. My own daughter wants to become a defence lawyer. So I understand their job is to find whatever they can to defend their client. But really, their arguments were limited here, given the amount of forensic evidence they had at hand. But because of the public interest, a gag order was issued. And then the defence brought up the searches of Westerfield's home, as well as some of the other evidence that were taken. But the defence wanted to suppress this evidence because they believed the warrants to be tainted. Ultimately, some statements at least were suppressed because apparently they were given before Westerfield was read his rights. But none of this included the physical evidence. Another dispute the evidence put forward surrounded the CSAM that was found on his computer. They wanted it separated from the murder charge. But honestly, that didn't make sense given how Danielle was found. The prosecution argued this was very relevant, basically providing a motive for the crime, why Westerfield wanted to abduct and murder a young girl. And then the defence tried to argue that the selected jurors had disqualifying bias from the publicity because this was heavily covered in the media. Understandably, this was a young girl abducted from her bed. This is terrifying as a parent that this is even possible. Obviously, everyone wanted justice. They wanted answers. They wanted the bad guy to be locked away forever. But this was also dismissed because the court was comfortable that the selected jurors were shielded from outside influence since their selection. Finally, the trial started June 4th, 2002. From the start, the prosecution's case was strong. They theorised that Westerfeld entered the Van Dam home through an unlocked door, abducted Danielle, and acted out unforgivable, disgusting sexual fantasies, which he saw on the CSAM that was found on his computer. The defence pushed back on this. They attempted to focus not on the evidence, and instead questioned, how would it be that Westerfeld could have apparently entered an unfamiliar home, located Danielle in the dark, and removed her without waking anyone, or while not leaving any DNA of his own behind? Now, obviously the defence knew the evidence was against them, so I guess here they are hoping to plant the seed of reasonable doubt. Westerfeld's defence team would claim that their client was improperly interrogated for an excessive amount of time. Basically, he wasn't given any food or drink. The defence argued that the police rushed to conclusions and ignored any other possible suspects, questioning the morals of Brenda and Damon Van Dam, alluding to allowing basically strangers into their home for sexual purposes. Quote, "I don't think they realise the dangers of the lifestyle they engage in. If you engage in a drug and risque sexual lifestyle, your children are endangered." Unquote. The defence alleging that any one of these supposed sexual partners could have kidnapped and murdered their daughter. That Damon had lied to police about the night Danielle died. That he was smoking marijuana and was in bed with one of his wife's friends. Now, Damon would testify that yes, he was smoking marijuana that night, but only lied because he didn't want to risk losing his job. And that, yes, he had had sex with two of his wife's friends, but this was months before Danielle was taken. And these friends were with Brenda at the bar that night, and not with him. Now, I'm not about to judge anyone for what consenting adults do behind closed doors. This is none of my business, and really doesn't mean Brenda and Damon are bad parents. Honestly, just because they had this swinger lifestyle, that doesn't mean that they were quote-unquote asking for their daughter to be kidnapped and murdered. The two aren't correlated. But again, here is defence planting that seed of doubt into the jurors' minds, offering up potential other perpetrators that perhaps knew the house layout more than their client did, that would have had access to the house, and would potentially have their DNA already in the home. Now, another motive was suggested by the prosecution, and that was that Westerfeld was apparently angry because he was rejected by one of Brenda's friends. And hence, when that friend went back with Brenda to smoke some marijuana before they called it a night, Westerfeld broke into the home from rage. It was also suggested that, horrifically, he may have already been hiding in Danielle's room when Brenda returned home, and that he was literally waiting until everyone went to bed before carrying Danielle out of the house. Westerfeld's niece would testify during the criminal trial. She would talk about staying with him for a time when she was 6 or 7 years old. That one night she woke up to find his finger in her mouth. And as a reaction to this, she bit his finger. Now, she would also tell her parents what happened, and there was an argument about it. But it really never went any further than that. The authorities were never notified and no charges were filed. August 21st, 2002. The jury convicted David Westerfeld of first-degree murder, kidnapping, and possession of child sex abuse material. The media at the time described the crowd outside the courthouse as cheering as the verdicts were announced. Danielle's mother Brenda couldn't control her relief as the first guilty verdict was read out, Damon embracing her. Westerfeld was just staring down the jurors, two of which were actually in tears and refused to look at him, obviously devastated by everything they had heard and seen during the trial. August 28, 2002. This is when the trial moved into the sentencing portion. Now, the defence aimed for mitigation by focusing on him having no prior felony convictions, that he had a good work history. Westerfeld's family and friends spoke on his behalf, and honestly, I don't know how they did. I don't care how friendly someone is, whether he mows my lawns for me or helps out with a local, I don't know, charity group. I don't care how good of a friend he is. I don't care if he's my brother. As soon as someone lays their hands on a child, they are dead to me. I am not coming to their aid. But Westerfeld's defence team had the gall to say that their client was not amongst the worst of the worst. I beg to differ, but whatever. And they urged the jurors not to answer to public anger with another death, arguing that two deaths would never justify one. But the jury didn't feel any sympathy for this excuse of a man. The jury recommended death, which I don't question for a moment would have been an easy decision. It is an immense weight placed on the jurors, and I commend anyone who sits on any jury. One juror did ask to leave the courtroom, as it became all too much at this point. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors. January 3rd, 2003 was the final sentencing hearing. Again, Westerfield's defence team attacked the fairness of the process. They argued that the media frenzy and police conduct should move the court in sparing Westerfield's life. Quote, America's changed. It's where capital murder trials have become summer entertainment. Unquote. Now, the judge rejected those arguments and called the crime extremely cruel and vicious. He then sentenced David Westerfield to death. The court also imposed an 11-year term on the kidnapping conviction and also sentenced him to time to be served on the CSAM that he had. Now, as always with the death penalty, there is an automatic appeal process that must go ahead. February 2019, the California Supreme Court affirmed the conviction and the death sentence. The court also denied the motion to modify the verdict from death to life without parole. A rehearing was also denied April 10, 2019. Westerfield is currently incarcerated at the High Desert State Prison. And due to an ongoing 2006 moratorium on executions in California, it means it's unclear if he will ever be executed. The Van Dam settled a lawsuit with Westerfield, receiving $416,000 from insurance companies that insured his property. The settlement prevents Westerfield from ever profiting from his crimes. Now, in 2003, San Diego police received a letter claiming responsibility for Danielle's murder. The author, James Shelby, had a history of sex-related crimes in five different states. He also claimed responsibility for the murder of JonBenet Ramsey, a case that I'm sure we're all familiar with. Now, this letter was forensically examined, but it was not deemed credible. James Shelby would actually take his own life while he was awaiting sentencing in Arizona, November 22, 2004.
The Danielle Van Dam Memorial Overpass on Interstate 8 at 2nd Street in El Cajon.
I think of Danielle Van Dam, and people see the sign and know the location where her body was found.
A memorial overpass in Danielle's name was constructed on Interstate 8 near where her body was discovered. The tragedy led to increased crime awareness in San Diego and the creation of the Danielle Legacy Foundation, which focuses on promoting volunteerism and children's safety. Danielle's family continues to honour her memory through their work in the community. If you have your own thoughts and theories on the story we discussed today, or any stories we talk about here on Stolen Lives, please search Stolen Lives Podcast on Facebook, like the page so you don't miss an episode, and join the Stolen Lives discussion group to talk about your thoughts and theories. You can also talk to us on Instagram, Stolen Lives Podcast. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you share this episode on your social media of choice. And subscribe and leave a positive review on your podcast app. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Ali. Hosting and production was also by me, Ali. Music is by Mayu.